So I'm very happy to introduce to you the speaker of this talk. The title is The Enemy, which is quite interesting, obvious, strange title. So it's really interesting what's going to happen. And the man who's standing next to me has been standing to people which I wouldn't like to stand next to, probably, and I'm also already afraid of this if I see them on TV. He's been a photographer in war zones all over the world for a long, long time, and I'm very happy that he's here today. Please welcome and give a nice applause to Karim Ben Khalifa.
That works. Thank you very much. Thank you, Nikolai. Thank you, Nora, for inviting me. I had to be here last year, but family events just prevented this. So I'm very happy to be here this year. I'm going to keep it silent and let you read this. I've been a war correspondent for the last 20 years. I am Belgian-Tunisian, and I've been a photojournalist, so using my camera and traveling to, as mentioned earlier, some of the darkest places in this world. I've worked for the best magazines, Vanity Fair, The New York Times Magazine, Le Monde, Stern here in Germany, covering numerous conflicts. And with those magazines, that's what a photojournalist wants to do, with those magazines, I've reached the best audiences. I mean, in my field, they are educated, they have the right to vote, they have a financial power. So those are the people I wanted to talk to and present them with my work through those magazines. I even won some awards for my work. So I was exactly where I wanted to be when I started. So let's back up a bit here. Why did I do this job? And I'm often asked the question, why do you go to wars and why do you do so? I think in my case, I mean, it's always different reasons, but I think in my case, one thing was very instrumental in bringing some curiosity about wars and the world. I don't know if you know Euronews. It's a news channel. Every half an hour, you have the news. But they have a short program, and this is it. No comment. And when I was a kid, I mean a kid, when I was 16, 17, 18, I was fascinated by the no comments. And why was I fascinated? Because for once, nobody tells me what to think. And I would look at it, and I wouldn't know who's right, who's wrong. The only information, and back in the days it was up in the corner, would be the date and the place. But there would be no voice over telling me what's going on. And usually that's the big news of the day, and that's right before the news. So I would find out after what was happening. And it's often wars, disasters, and so the no comment things, the no voice over, triggered my curiosity. And I started looking at it, trying to figure out what was happening. And then I was trying to think, what is outside of that frame that I don't see? And that really created for me a high sense of curiosity. And eventually, I went there. I went myself to see what was outside of this frame and see what I would do. So I wasn't doing video, I was doing photography. So that was years later. That was actually 20 years ago. There was a war in Kosovo, it was raging. And I bought a ticket and I went to Tirana in Albania. There I met with young kids coming from the UK, from Switzerland, from Germany. Young Kosovo that were coming to join the guerrilla. And I made friends with them, trying to understand their motivation. And then they went through training, because of course they were not trained to be guerrilla fighter. And I went and I witnessed their training, and eventually I crossed the border with them. So those are the moments where you start feeling, are you cut or not for this kind of job, walking through minefields on a border with Serbian snipers and really putting your feet exactly where the guy behind, in front of you has put his feet. And then witnessing, and this was August 1998, so let me remind you a little bit about this war. NATO came in, but that was in 99, and that was in March 99. So I had about 6 months to understand the ground, understand the people, understand the situation, and then from there, when the story became huge, because NATO was coming in, because journalists were coming from all over the world to cover the first NATO operation ever, I was ready. I knew the place. I could move around. I had contact. And yeah, this was my first war, which leads me to probably show you some photograph from that. And then there was Somalia, North Korea, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Lebanon. I was traveling. I was working for magazines. I was doing the job I wanted. The war in Iraq was really tough. It was a chaos. I operate very well in chaos. But I think, honestly, I've seen too much there. I've seen too much violence, too many people died, and it had a profound effect on my ability to work. My problem was I cannot do anything else. And this is the second and last slideshow I'm going to show you about my work, and then tell you about what I do today. And then there was Somalia, North Korea, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Lebanon. I was traveling. I was working for magazines. I was doing the job I wanted. The war in Iraq was really tough. It was a chaos. I operate very well in chaos. But I think, honestly, I've seen too much there. I've seen too much violence. Too many people died. And it had a profound effect on in 2009, after an assignment for Vanity Fair in the Gaza Strip, I was in Gaza City and I had decided to stay a bit longer. I was trying to find work on a story. And I was with a group of jihad Islamic fighters. And it was an open space. It was building around about that space. It's pretty big. And there were some trees and it was building around. But there was also one more thing. It was a huge hole. And this very characteristic hole of a bombing, you know, kind of a cone upside down. And I was with the fighters and I asked, what happened there? And they told me that a couple of days before, earlier, one of their group was wiped out by bombing from Israel, of course. And I look at the fighters. And I found them very young. And I thought, those must have been the kids that were in Gaza when I came here for the first time. So the circle of violence suddenly appeared to me. And then I keep thinking. And I thought, why do people accept to be photographed? Especially civilians. Why do they accept my presence and me photographing them? Do they just want a witness to their misery? Or do they hope that witness can actually change something? And I tell you, it's the latter. They think, or they hoped, I could do something. The reality is, I cannot. I'm facing a system, the media, and with this come a moral contract. And every time I was on the ground after this, I had this moral contract coming up to my mind. And I realized it would be really hard for me to keep doing this. And so, with this, kept going. This is the impossible moral contract. I couldn't, simply. So, the very same day, I was there. And you've seen what I do in photograph. More wide angle, try to be with the people. And then there, I did something. I'm not a portrait photographer, but I turned my camera. I put it this way. And I shot photos of the fighters that I was there. And I had a recorder. And I asked them 6 questions. Who's your enemy? Why? Did you ever kill him? What is violence to you? What is peace to you? And where do you see yourself in 20 years from now? I was trying to rethink my journalism at that point. I went to South Sudan and to Kashmir. And this is what it looked like on paper. But in my mind, it was not to be put on paper. It was to be put in a room where those two enemies would look at each other. And I would draw a border on the ground And when you would cross that border and go close to one of those guys, when close up the photograph, of course, you would hear him answering the questions. And when you would cross the border on the other side, you would hear his enemy answering exactly the same questions. So now, let's go back to those questions. Six questions, very simple. You heard them before. But they're two kind of questions. The three first question, it's about the other. Who's your enemy, why, and did you ever kill him? The three last questions are about themselves. What is violence to you? What is peace to you? And where do you see yourself in 20 years from now? There was one thing as a war correspondent, going from one side to the other. I would always humanize the people I was with. And not because I had to make this effort, just because I had human in front of me. And you know, as a photojournalist, you can only do photograph. But as a human being on the ground, you hear those people. You hear them talking about their family. You hear them talking about their dreams, their fears. And they suddenly appear extremely human. And I was wondering, how can I do this? How can I translate that? And who should see that if I do it? That was another publication, Foreign Policy Magazine in the US. That was recharging my journalism. I tell you, I've been struggling with this work. Eventually, I did three parts. But when I went to the magazine that I was working with, they look at it and they says, are you out of your mind? This is too arty. I says, it's arty? Okay, I'm going to go to the art world. And when I go to the art world, this is like, you out of your mind? This is way too war and storytelling. I was like, no, that's not for us. So I financed it myself. Eventually, Le Monde in Paris understood it a bit. You saw the publication here, and they helped me to do the last parts. But I was in the process of trying to recharge my journalism. I was in the process to try to do something for this moral contract. I didn't tell you, but I was kicked out of school. Maybe you figured that out already. I was 18, paf, out. And something beautiful happens. In 2012, I was invited at Harvard University. I'm going to make a little story here, but I called my dad and says, Dad, I'm going to Harvard University. He says, are you going to pay for that? Well, they're actually giving me $100,000 to spend a year there with the kids. But you never managed to pass an exam. I was like, there is no exam. I don't need to go through exams. I said, did you get an email? I says, yeah. Well, that might be Nigeria trying to scam you. Don't answer that email. 3 months later, my dad was there with me, extremely proud. Because in my family, we don't have any education. My dad didn't have a choice to have an education. I had, but I was too distracted. Let's put it this way. So I spent a year there. And you understood that I like to go where I don't belong. That's really part of my DNA. So there, I went to the Harvard Business School. That's the last place I should be. It was very interesting. I spent a year there. Corporate social responsibility. I went to the innovation lab, digital marketing strategies. Honestly, I didn't understand everything they were talking about. But I get one thing from there, the language. The language they're using, very useful if you want to talk and talk to people that can finance your work. From there, my luck wasn't over. I was invited at the MIT. I finally stayed 4 years at MIT, and they helped me produce and think and design The Enemy, which I'm about to start talking about. And that was in 2013. And 3 weeks into my fellowship at the Media Lab, we always receive invitation for new hardwares, new companies that want to demo their works. They're outside of the MIT, but want to bring people from the MIT to show what they do. And there, I went. I was invited to meet people from a small company called Oculus. It was still small back in the days. And that's the guy right before me. I was like, my God. I'm like, I'm low-tech. It's not the opposite of low-tech. I'm like, really? And I was like, this is weird. It was my turn after. And because I've made you a few confidence, I'm going to make one more. I have vertigo. I can go to a front line, but I have vertigo. And I was really unlucky that day because when I put this, I was on the side of a mountain. Well, I was sitting at MIT, but I was on the side of a mountain. I looked down and I felt the vertigo coming in me. 2 minutes, remove the headset. I don't like to have vertigo. So I removed the headset. Said, thank you very much. I walked out. I didn't walk out for a long time. I came back 15 minutes later. And I tell them, I have this project. It's called Portrait of the Enemies. It's 2 photographs. There is a board in between. Well, let me cut short that. Can I put the people in a room? Would that be possible with that technology? Back in 2013, they were like scratching their heads. As I guess, yeah, that should be possible. Might be very expensive, but this is possible. At that point, I had 0 funding. I didn't really have a project. Who says, I don't care if it's expensive. We'll see after. But can we do that? Okay. So I started investigating and started thinking about what it would look like. And definitely, I was really interested to see what would happen to journalism if the people I meet are actually in the front of the audience. Because right now, you're figuring out who am I through what I say, but also through my body language. And what would happen if you got those fighters right in front of you, not threatening you, just answering the question you know about? What would happen to journalism? I'll tell you after. The Enemy was born out of my frustration as a photojournalist and war correspondent. For almost 20 years, I have photographed conflicts and witnessed the consequences of huge geopolitical shifts. When I became a father, I simply knew I could not keep working on the front lines. Yet, I was not done trying to understand wars.
Oh, mina ba waka juna bo bana ni waka.
My friends in Israel, when they know I'm heading for Gaza, can't help themselves but to wish me luck and to stay safe. They believe a lot of people in Gaza are irrational. Also, when I spend weeks working in Gaza and I'm about to return to Israel, my Palestinian friends are telling me the exact same thing. Be careful there. The project is rooted in my experience as a war photographer, going from one side of the front line to the other and finding that the fighters' dreams, hopes, and nightmares are often more similar than they are different. So there is a bigger story than the war itself, and this is the one I want to explore and share. For The Enemy, I am using the latest technologies in virtual and augmented realities so you can engage directly with the combatants and meet them, hear them, and feel them the way I did. In many parts of our worlds, you create an enemy as a kid without having met your enemy, because the society around you has created an enemy in the other. So the question is, could I be you if I was on the other side? So from 2013, it took 4 years to do that because it didn't exist. There was no way. I had to go to Gaza, I had to go to Salvador, to Congo. I needed a portable studio. I needed, you know, we heard of 360 video. I do the opposite. I do 0 degrees. All the cameras are pointing at my protagonist, recording every single of their move, scanning their body, making a lot of photographs, and then rebuilding the whole thing. nothing like this existed, so we had to kind of play around, and I surrounded myself with the people who can actually help me doing this. And trying to get engaged with journalism in a very different way and trying to push the boundaries of what I do. My idea with this also was this moral contract, you remember? Who should see this work? Who can have an impact if they look at this? Who can change the situation? And obviously, it's great to be in New York, or it's great to be in Montreal, or in Paris, or in Germany. But the people who can really make a difference are the next generation of fighters. So we've been working and trying to push that there as much as we could. I need to say thank you to Camera Lucida. It's a production company. They had no idea what they were going into. I had no idea neither. And they stuck with me to the end, and it took 4 years. And then all the other partners. And interestingly enough, there's not a single media in this. There's not a newspaper or a magazine. But those are organizations that care about journalism, and, as me, want to push it a bit further. We talked about this. Maybe I should show you a bit what it looks like inside, to give you an idea, because I'm not bringing you to Gaza, or to Salvador, or to Congo, but I bring you the protagonist. It's just a short extract. It's a 300-meter square installation. It's multi-user, 20 people at the same time. You walk the space, and at some point you end up in between two fighters. You're going to make a choice. Who are you going to listen first? And what does it look like from the outside? Backpack, tracking system. All of this is super expensive, of course. Not only the hardware, but to produce what was inside. But you got 20 people and nobody's touching each other because we created a transparent avatar with an Oculus, so you see the other users. They're absolutely uninteresting, so you keep on being focused in the content. But this is heavy to move and expensive to move. We have to do all this content. And so I've proposed at some point in the project to reach this new audience, the next generation of fighters, to create an augmented reality app that people could download that would be for free on the App Store and the Android Store, and where you would have the same content, and where you could listen to the same interview. So at the end, you'll see the website of the project, and from there you can get a link and download it if you're interested. And then suddenly we can bring this in different places. I mean, we don't have to bring it. The people are taking it themselves. It's the French version of the app.
L'ennemi, l'autre. Cet être imprévisible, irrationnel, ce sanguinaire. Il est toujours invisible, mais il est là, quelque part. Te voici entouré des 6 combattants que j'ai rencontrés. Ta présence peut tout changer. Qui veux-tu rejoindre en premier ?
Bonjour.
Salam alaykoum.
Abou Khaled, qui est ton ennemi et pourquoi?
And we were right to do this. The app has been downloaded in 102 countries. And of course, I could not bring the VR in 102 countries. And it's very interesting to see that suddenly organizations working on reconciliation are using the work to trigger the conversation. And I think journalism doesn't need to be exactly this, but can also be that. And so, for people that are less experienced, I mean, I think this room is literacy in media is really high. But what if you bring young people from Congo in the VR? They're going to be a bit lost in this. They don't have the same literacy we have. But if you bring on an iPad or on a phone, in his own surrounding, in his village or in his city, his enemy there, where he is, it becomes extremely powerful and it triggers conversation. And when those conversations are followed with reconciliation or peace-building organization, then we start moving a bit further and journalism can help that. Lesson learned, guys, I've learned a lot of things doing this. I'll start by saying I think journalism is extremely important to bring another point of view. And when we see what's happening in the world today, journalism is more than ever very important. And I'm committed in my own capacity to innovate and push the boundaries and try to find solutions for younger generation to be, you know, taking journalism. And as a matter of fact, when we've put schools through the 50 minutes experience of the VR, and for 50 minutes, they're listening to those people. And they're coming out and they've understood it. Without a snapshot, without being interrupted with their phones, 50 minutes. It's something that we don't see so much anymore, especially with younger generation. They said we really need to experiment with journalism. And this is what I've realized by pushing boundaries and see what sticks on the wall, what works, what doesn't work. And what I like to say is the frustration that I had in my work have become my engine to try to change the things. I've also started thinking very differently now. I know we're in a like high-tech kind of a conference, but for me, the story first. Who do you want to tell the story to? And what would be the best medium to tell that story? When I was a photojournalist, it would be exactly the other way around. The medium would, like, that's it. Magazines, and then the audience, we know who they are, and then you push a story through that tube. I've completely changed that. You know, you understood the 300 meter square installation where you need to walk, where you get closer to the fighters, they're engaging you in the eyes, they're staring at you, they're talking directly to you, even though I'm the one who asked the questions. But if you think about it, journalism is very passive. You turn the radio in your car, in your kitchen, you read the magazine in a comfortable couch. You turn the TV on, maybe in your bedroom or in your living room. But it's passive. I mean, beside the fact that you turn it on, then boom, it gives it to you. This is becoming active. You going through 100% of what I wanted to tell you, but you're doing on your own terms, whenever you want. Maybe you want to go and listen to this guy first, as opposed to the other one. And that's changed something fundamentally in journalism. And in my work, and I realized it as I was doing it. And so I quoted this phrase, wrote that. People are talking when they leave the enemy, they're talking of an experience. They're not talking of a storytelling. They have the memory of having met some people. And I find this is very interesting because an experience is stronger than a story. And for a storyteller, it's good to find out. Now the challenge will be to create more experience in which people are feeling the same things, but it's very interesting to work in that direction. The enemy calls on your instinct, and the instincts make you feel the experience. So what happens when journalism becomes an experience? I'm not really sure. I don't know how that affects your memory. I don't know how much that changes your point of view. The only thing I can tell you is the debrief I have with my audience. And it's very, very interesting. I have a testimony that I'm going to put in a few seconds. I'm getting at the end of the talk. You remember that sentence at the start? I'll put it again here. And
it's like this. I'm going to go to the בעיקר להעיף אותי. אז אתה מסתכל הבוחל בעיניים, אתה לא יכול באמת להגיד שהוא אויב שלך. בסך הכל מה הוא עושה? הוא נלחם בשביל החירות שלו כמו שאתה נלחם בשביל זה. נלחם בשביל החיים שלו ובשביל המשפחה שלו. כאילו זה טיפה יותר גרם לי להבין שהצד השני הוא נהל באותה צורה בדיוק כמונו. זה עוד שנה, לא יודע מה אני אעשה בצבא, אבל בטוח זה יהיה משהו... אי אפשר לדעת כאילו, זה בטוח יהיה משהו כנגד האויב, כביכול. כאילו, אני הולך להילחם נגדו, ומי שהסתכלתי לו בעיניים עכשיו. זה... נורא מוזר, כי גם כשאתה חייל, אתה לא מקבל את ההזדמנות הזאת לעמוד מול האויב שלך ולשמוע אותו, זה בטוח לא מה שאתה מקבל בצבא. אז זה היה מעניין.
And that was a presentation in Israel. And it was fascinating to see young Israeli walking towards Abu Khaled, the Palestinian fighter from Gaza, because they cannot do that anywhere. There's no way they would kill each other. One would shoot, but there, listening and going, and the physicality has really become that to an experiential level, and this young man is in the military and suddenly has another point of view and suddenly realized the other one is way more similar than he thought or than he's been taught. Thank you very much. This is the end of my talk, and I think we've got a few minutes of Q&A.
Thank you so much, man.
My pleasure.
So, I still got shivers in my spine. Sorry. Amazing. Okay, you have the chance to ask questions. Please just go up to a microphone and be patient. I will call you up as soon as I can. And I have first question over there at number 5. Please, your question.
Hello.
Oh, yes.
Thanks for the talks. Thanks for the work first. It's a bit of a naive question.
Yeah, I see you. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries. I was wondering how to make it as efficient as possible. So you were talking about who the audience is, and I was wondering, should it be the next generation of fighter, the person who is inviting them to become a fighter? And then I thought, okay, that's in very key places now, but I'm French, I was supposed to be doing military service if I wanted to, but I cannot imagine French military when I have the possibility to decide to do military service or not, to show me an experience like this.
Of course.
But I wish they would.
Well, a little anecdote, and maybe that's going to help answering that question. When we presented in Israel, at some point my team comes and says, Karim, there's a couple of militaries there in the line to do the enemy. What do we do? I was like, what do you mean? What do we do? Let them in. It's a pleasure to have them in. And they worked for the Israeli Defense Force Academy. They went through. We're obviously very impressed. It was a young guy and an older guy. And the young guy takes me apart and says, you know, I'm human too. But he says that really away from his boss. And then I talk with the boss, and pushing that a bit further, seems interested, and I says, you know, it would be a pleasure to bring this to the academy. That's really bringing a wolf into a sheep house. And they give me, honestly, the best compliment I could have from the military that says, we're not in the same business. Meaning I'm rehumanizing, and they need to make sure that Gilad shoots Abu Khaled. And that for me, when the military says that, I think I'm onto something interesting. Thank you for the question.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so next question. I'll start from the back. I have seen you. Number 3, please.
Hello, thanks for your talk. It's an amazing work.
Okay, cool.
So still I have a sort of critical question.
Please.
First of all, I think it's an experience when people experience the VR, but before it's an experience, it's still a story, right? Because you, as the artist, create a story for the people to have an experience. So it's still a story, just a different kind of technological possibility to participate or to view it or read it or whatever. Engage, exactly. So my question is, I'm wondering, and this is a general question I have concerning this kind of VR and the idea of being able to force experiencing empathy with VR. So my question is, isn't there a danger in that sense that now I can only engage in the story by being part of it and not by experiencing the other as the other? So empathy is not about feeling something for the other person, but it's just always something I can feel and I can act on as being part of it. And I wonder whether there is a sort of danger in there. I see the possibilities, but I still wonder whether it's more kind of even more egocentric point of view afterwards.
I think there is two things I want to say about this. First one, I don't use the word empathy. Thing is, I started using it with this work, and when I was at MIT being in MIT, I start talking about this, and I discover, as of today, scientifically, there is 7 kind of empathy. You carry some empathy that might be different from the person that is next to you. Maybe he's got more, maybe he's got less. That's a characterial empathy. Situational empathy, contextual empathy. There is a lot of things. And I even tell you, the worst is you can go the opposite of what you wanted, meaning you create empathy for your own people against the other. So there is a danger using these words. I'm using a word that is much more charged in terms of religion, but for lack of a better one, it's compassion or altruism, and trying to bring this to the people. So that one thing. And to really clearly answer your question, I think, yes, of course, it's hard-coded. Of course, it's a story. You're absolutely right. I'm not pretending it's anything else than this. Happened that the story has become experiential, and I'm not saying this. That's my audience that says that. And there is a danger, of course. But if you think about the TV and how it has brainwashed millions of people, well, yes, no. Still use the word couch potato. I mean, there is a lot. And if you go, and I'm not going to stereotype here, but if you go in the US in an hotel and you start zapping, my God, I'm like, what is there that it really brings a critical mind? What I'm trying to bring here is the critical mind. It's put the position in between two people where people, I'm not telling them who's right and who's wrong. I let the audience decide what they have to take out of this. And to finish, answering your question, yes, of course, there is a danger, because if you can do this, you can do the exact opposite. And I have way less budgets than, you know, armies, the US Army, the UK, Germany, sorry, Israel, or whatever. Thank you for your question. I hope it helps.
Okay. Die Nummer 8 kommt gleich. Ich nehme erstmal die Nummer 2 und dann die 3 und die 7, ja? Nummer 2, bitte.
Thank you very much for your talk. One question. You're bringing together the people. They see the enemy not as their enemy anymore, and this might actually, I would say, prevent further animosities. But what about the governments or the parties that actually want to lead this war? Did you ever have problems with them?
That was one of the reasons. We also moved to augmented reality because they can prevent us from coming in the country with the VR installation, but they'll struggle a lot to stop the app being downloaded. I guess I'm not such a danger anyway. You know what I mean? I'm not going to stop those wars, neither Congo, neither the Salvador, the Machas, or Israel-Palestine. Now let's stay humble here. I'm trying to experiment with journalism and see what happens when we do this. But no, I didn't had any so far trouble with governments. I'm going back to Israel in a couple of weeks. Maybe we'll keep in touch and I'll let you know. Thank you.
Okay, number 8, please.
Number 8? Where is number 8?
Hi. How did you create the avatars used for the people you interviewed? Did you digitize them or did you create them from photos or something?
So I didn't do it because I'm really bad in technology, but my team did. And the way we do that is we scan their body. We used different techniques along the conflicts. We did one conflict each year. First one was Israel-Palestine. The second one is when we went to the DRC, Congo, Eastern Congo. And then the last one was Salvador. We used, because it was a year apart, and you know those technologies are moving fast, we used different techniques on the way. But we basically scanned their body. So we have the proportion, their size, how they are. We make about 100 photographs. We put them all on this, and then protagonist is not moving, and then from there we reanimate everything. And this is, I guess, where most of the money goes. It's to reanimate based on all the videos we've got from the interview. So we know when they close their eyes, we know when they move, when they put their hand down, all of this, and we recreate second by second everything they've done. The only freedom we allowed ourselves is the fact that they're looking at you. So they're engaging, they're not engaging you all the time and straight in the eyes, but they do about 60% of the time, they're talking to you directly. And that's the only kind of freedom I took to bring a level of engagement with my audience. Thank you.
Number 7 has been waiting so patiently, please.
So people usually say that virtual reality is the ultimate empathy machine, and it is quite naive, but your work seems to show that immersive media is definitely something that is very beneficial for journalism itself. However, I would like to ask you how much you see that the novelty of the medium itself is one of the big factors that drives the impact that you can create with your work. As you know, when we are used to see television or radio news, and we somehow filter them. We just seen too much stuff on the TV, but people have not been that often in those immersive experiences. Do you think that we, or you as a journalist, need to continue adapting new methods over and over again, like volumetric video and more and more and more, to keep this engagement? Or do you think that when people say, you know, it's a ultimate empathy machine, that this ultimate is exactly where we need to go, and we don't need to go further with the technology, and everyone just needs to switch to immersive media, and everything will be just fine, and journalism will be fixed forever?
No, I don't think so. I think it's very naive to say this is an empathy machine, because you can do the exact opposite. Also, you can reinforce stereotypes. Is this the future of journalism? No, I don't think so, neither. But it's interesting to experiment, it's interesting to see how audience are reacting to this and going to the novelty of the medium, of course. I'm not sure it will be that efficient 10 years from now when people are much more used to virtual reality and virtual reality environments and interactions. But for a lot of people, it was the first time they were doing anything like this. Not the first time probably they were doing VR, some of them of course. But at least the first time they were really having a meeting. I'm careful with my word here, but the first encounters they had in VR with someone engaging them directly. I think it always makes a difference when you know what you're looking at is real, and that's why it's labeled journalism, in a way that those six men exist, they're still alive, and they're active fighters, they're not generals or whatever. They're like the foot soldiers. They're not the people who think the war, they're just the people who do the war. And in that sense, I think the novelty of the medium has really helped the work, not only getting produced, but also having the impact it had on the audience. I'm not sure it would be the same 5 or 10 years down the line, but this, I don't know what's happening in 5 or 10 years down the line. Maybe other things will come. Definitely sensory media and more sensory things adding will enhance your experience, but again, we'll get used to everything eventually.
Okay, so we just have 10 more minutes. We need to speed up a little bit. I've seen you. I will take your questions, but I'll go to the back at first. Number 3, please.
Hello. You said you felt obligated to help the people you photographed, and my question is, do you have any evidence that this is more helpful to them than if you put the same time, effort, money into some ordinary charity?
I don't know how to answer that question, honestly. I think those are two different things and two different motivations. I'm certainly think it's valuable to help and to do charity. But I think we need to innovate, and if we all the money of innovation goes in charity, certainly we'll have a much more better world in a way that everyone's got bread and a work, but that doesn't mean we're moving forward. I don't know. It's really a hard question to understand and to answer. Is it better to invest money in journalism, or is it better to give it to charity? I don't know. Maybe the audience has an answer about this, but I don't actually. But thank you for the questions anyway. Sorry.
Okay. Now, Mr. Microphone number 4, please.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about the completeness of the last episode of your work, because you've shown an Israeli soldier, a guy before he's a soldier, answering questions after seeing the video. And I was wondering if you have a similar video of showing somebody from the other side as to complete that section.
I don't, because I was really working hard to bring it to Palestine. And not to say that I bang against the wall to make a bet, but the Palestinian didn't want it to have it. And I really went to the most liberal people, to the most open-minded people, and they were not willing to take the work. They understood it. Their words was, listen, I don't see how we should right now be creating empathy or compassion for the other side. They are the strong one. They are the one who maintain the occupation. Those are not my words. Those are their words. But at the end of the day, I mean, and congratulations to the Israeli side, who's much more open-minded and accepted to challenge whatever their society allows that to bring it there. But I've been struggling with the Palestinian side. Same way I have Lebanese friends who says, oh, we would love to get that. And when they find out there is an Israeli in it, it's like, forget about it. We cannot bring this in Beirut. So yeah, I mean, there is numbers of issues and political issues that are beyond my capacity to bring it there. Now, this said, I know the app has been downloaded a lot in Palestine, but it's not the VR thing, and I don't have testimony of Palestinians telling me what they think about it.
Thank you. Okay, so...
Number two is very patient.
I know, they're please. Very patient. Number two, please.
Thank you. You mentioned that moral contract repeatedly.
Yeah.
So I would just be curious to hear what exactly does that consist of for you? What does that moral contract comprise?
Okay, so maybe I haven't been very clear about it. When you are on the ground and you photograph civilians, especially civilians, I mean, army or guerrillas have always a form of an agenda. They want to show who they are and kind of, we're on the good side of history, even though they're not always. But when you photograph civilians in the worst time of their life, imagine, I don't know where you live, I don't know what you do, but imagine you going through terrible events in your life and you see a journalist with a camera come. Would you appreciate to be photographed at that time? No. So why do they accept it? And this is my questioning. And that, for me, becomes the moral contract. Do they accept just because they want to show the misery in which they are, which you just said, no, I wouldn't want to show that? Or do they hope that actually that witness bringing this to the media would affect their situation? And that, for me, becomes the moral contract. Thank you very much.
Okay, we don't have so much time anymore. I will take question number two, question number one, but first, the signal angel, thank you, and the rest, I'm sorry, thanks.
Yeah, the question came up whether the installation can still be visited and if it's still on the go.
It's still on the go, it's in Geneva. We're working on bringing it in Berlin in 2020. We need some help, so if someone has 300 meters square and willing to welcome us, we'll be happy to come. And we're working on a South American tour right now with translation in Spanish. The thing is, because it didn't exist before, we need to kind of educate a lot of the places we're going into. Because you've got a tracking system, you need a technical team. It's not that easy, and you have a lot of computers, hardware. So we're more aiming at museums and institutions that have the capacity to welcome such a thing. But even those institutions are struggling because it's high tech. So that's part of the thing we're trying to help the people. We had zillions of propositions, but we had zillions minus a numbers of time where we did present it, where I said, like, it's too complicated. Guys, I don't know how we're going to deal with this. So, of course, I mean, I guess most of you would be able to deal with this because you're educated in this, but it's not a case of museums, which usually are kind of old and more towards the past. But there is an interest, and I hope more and more will, if not the enemy, some other works. Thank you.
Okay. Microphone two, please. Thanks.
Thank you. So I've recently helped run a study where we used a very similar setup with virtual reality to, and we showed that you can use that to induce empathy, but that with that empathy comes along a reduced ability to what psychologists call perspective taking, but essentially it means you get worse at understanding that the other person might have a different perspective and knowledge and experiences, and because you kind of like blur the boundaries. And that kind of like gives the worry that, you know, something like this gives you the sense that you've understood the other person, but that understanding might be misleading because, you know, if I were to look at some fighter, I might get the sense that I feel them and I feel like a connection to them, but they've had very different experiences that I don't really know about, don't have access to. So can you maybe speak to that worry of the misleading sense of understanding in your work?
Of course. I think the worst that can happen is to be extremely, extremely impactful and efficient. And that person that has changed perspective, let's say it does really happen, goes back to its community. And the community hasn't changed, but he has. And that can be extremely problematic. Because suddenly he's like, well, but you know what? They're also human. Puff. Are you out of your mind? No, they're not. Because he's changed and the other one not. So that for me, but that doesn't really clearly answer your question. But that's a nightmare situation for me. When you try to be impactful, and sometimes you can also bring people into trouble because they've changed that perspective. And I don't know if the efficiency of it is not really bringing the other's perspective. I don't think, I mean, we should extend that conversation to what is true and what is not. We all construct through stories or through interaction, human interactions, an idea of who's the other. In this case, I think I've done a system that is very simple. The question is similar, and you know those are active fighters. And I hope that the sense of agency that is offered during the installation and the choice you make appeal on really your own instinct. And then you walk out of this with more questions than you had before you walked in. And that is really my intention in that sense. Is I want, as a journalist, I want people to think or to rethink their relation to the other. I'm not here to really tell them exactly what they should think. So in that sense, I let the user, and I would love to do a neuroscience study, which we're working with an Israeli a neuroscientist, to put the two groups in it, the Palestinian and the Israeli, and see 6 months or a year down the line if they change perspective. This I don't have the answer, and I would love to find out if there is really a conceptual change, first a conceptual change of perspective, and then like a real change after.
Okay, so last minute, last question, please. Number one.
Thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
So I have one question. I think the technique is very useful to show equality of human beings as human beings because of the empathy or the whatever you call it. But I think to understand conflict situations, it's also very important to have a grasp of the history that led to that situation, that, for example, you can't show stuff like that in Palestine, and in Israel you have an open society who is ready to reflect on that. The question is, do you have any ideas how to implement with that technique more historic perspectives and more like abstract knowledge, or is it useless for that? What's your opinion?
I don't think it's useless. I don't think knowing history is useless. It depends where you read the history, and the history is written by the winners. It's never written by the people who've been conquered. So in that sense, we can also be very critical about history and who writes history. But yes, definitely having a more understanding of the geopolitical context in which those wars are happening, or the reason why they're happening. In this case, there's three different conflicts. One is criminality and racketeering, Salvador. Congo is about the resource. We're all using phones and computers. They don't work without the rare minerals from Congo. So we are responsible for the conflict there. And just because that pissed me off, 6 million deaths since 20 years. And that goes like this because all digital needs and hardware, it's going through the roof. So that's just a part of history also. And Israel, Palestine, whew, I'm not touching that history. Simply not. You get a big hammer from one side or the other. But yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, so time is up and that's a good finisher. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Venkat and Kalipa.